Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Explaining History podcast, and in this episode we're going to look back at the Spanish Civil War again and examine Franco's march on Madrid in 1936. Just to give you a little bit of context here, for those that are less familiar with the war, you can check out the previous podcasts I've done on it in the last few weeks. But following the airlift from North Africa, from Morocco, provided by Hitler, Franco and the Army of Africa was able to return from a rather ill-advised exile imposed by the Republican government to mainland Spain. Franco and his fellow generals had launched a coup in North Africa. It was the only place realistically that it could happen, where there were sufficient numbers of troops that were sufficiently disloyal to the Republic. And had it not been for Hitler's intervention, the coup may well have died out in North Africa, but Hitler's airlift taking 15,000 troops across to Spain, landing in Andalusia, made the uprising a serious threat to the Republican government. The advance of Franco's forces came broadly from the south and the west, moving eastwards from the border with Portugal, where there had been a considerable amount of cooperation and assistance from the dictatorship in Portugal. And it was explicit on the part of Franco that it was a military dictatorship that he would be imposing upon Spain. As his forces moved across the country, the various disparate nationalist, Catholic and fascist movements formed together into one political force behind Franco, which also incorporated the various monarchist factions that were still a significant political force within Spain. These worked together and banded together in the Bando Nacional, or the Nationalist faction. Just as the British Union of Fascists had been an agglomeration of smaller fascist groups under the banner of one fascist organisation. And in some ways, Nazism was not entirely dissimilar, as the movement that Hitler created in the south, in Bavaria, was actually joined in the 1920s by almost kind of autonomous Nazi organisations that had developed largely independently of Hitler himself from across the rest of Germany. Fascism and fascisms seem often to be kind of flotillas of fellow travellers who come under banners of convenience where there is a broad spread of very similar racial, nationalistic, violent, militaristic, authoritarian views, with certain subtle differences as to kind of post-revolution and post-coup economic and social plans, though these are largely cosmetic. And of course, Franco drew directly from the success of Mussolini and Hitler. His slogan, "One Fatherland, One State and One Chief," was of course directly derived from the Nazi "Ein Volk, Ein Reich, Ein Führer." And there's a reason for this, that fascism in general follows, and particularly the three key European fascisms of Italy, Germany and Spain, had a great deal in common in terms of their operating ideas. The problems of the present could always be explained not only by an evil external or internal enemy, but by the idea that a once great and glorious people had, through a corruption of their values or some kind of racial corruption, fallen by the wayside and lost touch with that which was great and glorious about them. The Spanish fascism looked back to the glories of the Spanish Middle Ages, to the twin kingdoms of Aragon and Castile, and the union of the two crowns, and the expulsion of both Jews and Muslims from Spain, just as Italian fascism looked back to the imagined glories of the Roman Empire, and German fascism looked to the rather kind of mythologized Germanic Middle Ages of Teutonic Knights, castles along the Rhine, and the Norse and Nordic dramas as portrayed in The Ring Cycle and Wagner and all that kind of thing. So looking into the past to find the answers there to the problems of the present, normally very romantic, militaristic and authoritarian answers that could be applied to the complexities of the present dealing with the economic and social and political crises of the early 20th century. Of course, there's nothing in the past that can really address the threat of communism. There's nothing in the past that can realistically address world economic crisis, and a crisis of capitalism, or any of the modern 20th century dilemmas that faced nation states in Europe in the 1930s. But these visions of an untrammelled past, of a kind of a purer, more rarefied sense of people and identity, these are wildly popular, perhaps because of their simplicity and perhaps because of their implied rejection of modernity and the challenges that modernity brought with it. The irony, of course, is that all fascisms, Spain included, used the tools of modernity, from aircraft to radios to modern propaganda techniques and all the power of modern mass production. And here we can see the kind of ideological incoherence at the heart of fascism. When Franco thought about the past, he was convinced that the war that he was fighting was really a war on behalf of traditional Spain, Catholic Spain, against the increasingly secular world. And just like Hitler, Franco associated modernity, secularism and modern thinking with this kind of rather strange and concocted idea of it being Jewish Marxism. The conflation of Judaism and the Jewish people and Marxism was central to the conspiratorial thinking of most European fascists. What was curious about Spain, a country where there were virtually no Jews at all, having all been expelled many centuries beforehand, was that anti-Semitism lingered as a powerful force within Spanish fascist thinking. The forces that Franco wished to return to power were the power of the army, the church, the landed estates, and finally, and this was the most preposterous of all, Spain's overseas empire in South America. There was obviously no chance whatsoever that this would be restored, but it didn't mean that it couldn't be a popular rallying cry to the fascist movement and to those fellow travellers who supported it. The destruction of the entire infrastructure of democratic life in Spain would be obviously integral to that whole process. The end of elections, the end of any other political party other than the national bloc, the destruction of trade unions would be accompanied by mass terror, and it would be a largely class-based mass terror that saw the peasants and the Spanish working class bear the brunt of mass killing, torture, rape and arbitrary execution. The extent to which the Catholic Church had become complicit in the crimes of Franco and the fascist right is really quite revealing. It was the Jesuit movement in Spain and the Catholic hierarchy in Spain that were most the most overtly politicised, reactionary and committed to supporting the generals. Jesuit priests were more than happy to publish the anti-Semitic tract, the anti-Semitic forgery, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. These were serialised in Jesuit publications, and Franco promised to return control over key parts of public life to the church. Franco's dictatorship would enable a wholesale assault on women's rights, particularly the right for divorce. Any educational improvements and changes under the Republic were undone, particularly those which challenged notions of Christian doctrine, and the prayer to the Virgin Mary would be led by teachers on a daily basis. Franco encouraged bishops, and they were not reticent to do this, to join in the fascist salute, and the church was a site, and the churches were across Spain were sites for book burnings. Books that were considered politically or scientifically contrary to church doctrine, to Christian doctrine, were torched. In Adam Hochschild's book, Spain in Our Hearts, which is an account of Americans in the Spanish Civil War, really excellent read, much like Unlikely Warriors by Richard Maxwell on the British volunteers in Spain. He wrote that Cardinal Isidro Gomá, who was the Archbishop of Toledo and Primate of all of Spain, said that the war in Spain was a clash of civilization with barbarism, and that the nationalists were bravely fighting dark societies controlled by the Semite International.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So this was an idea that was deep-rooted in the nationalist assault across Spain. The idea that the Republic had brought Christian civilization in Europe to the brink of destruction, and that only through this bloodthirsty campaign of mass murder across Spain could Christianity within the country be salvaged at all. There are numerous accounts of priests engaging in war crimes, the execution of prisoners, burying prisoners alive, executing people in confession booths, this kind of thing. And so it shows you how far the Catholic Church, at really every level, had become entwined with the murderous behaviour of the Franco regime. To give you a kind of comparison, when you look at the two concordats, the Italian and the Nazi German concordat, there was a complicity with the regime. But bear in mind, by 1937, as Hitler had broken his promises to the Catholic Church, the Pope had made the papal encyclical with burning concern, Mit Brenne der Sorge, which had been smuggled across Germany and had been a source of immense outrage to Hitler. And you can find out more about that story on the podcast I did, it must have been last year sometime, on the Concordat and Hitler and the Catholic Church. But that was 1937. We're talking about 1936. So in roughly a similar time period, there was a cooling of relations between the Vatican and Hitler. And yet, in Spain, a seemingly far more autonomous hierarchy of priests, bishops, archbishops, was able to interpret its role in the Civil War and its relationship to fascism in an entirely different and far more violent way. Franco made no secret of his plans to raise Madrid to the ground. The pace of nationalist advance was so rapid that in one instance, Francisco Largo Caballero, the Prime Minister of the Republic, he rang the commander of Illescas, which was 20 miles southwest of Madrid. And when he got through, he found himself talking to the nationalist general that had seized the town. Taking Madrid was a symbolic act for Franco. Firstly, it would have dealt the Republic an almost fatal blow, but it was also obviously the Republic's capital, and seizing it would have shown that the coup was all but over. In November 1936, the front line becomes the outskirts of Madrid itself. Reasonably poorly trained and poorly led, low morale Republican soldiers began to panic, drop their weapons and flee when the first artillery shells began to pour down onto the city. And they have to be stopped in a rather Soviet fashion of officers pointing pistols at them in order to get them back to the front line. The government assumed that the city was lost and began to pull back to Valencia. The shortages of ammunition and food supplies meant that government departments loaded up onto a long convoy of trucks and transports and drove to Valencia, a sufficiently long way away from the front line. And as the government pulled out, refugees poured in. It was a standard tactic of the Nazis in the Second World War, but learned in Spain that where flows of refugees went, so went chaos with them, and the need to provide for them in a humanitarian manner. And this meant, this hampered the ability of fighting forces. The loss of important areas of farmland to the nationalists, the flow of refugees, the lack of supplies, meant that the potential for famine in Madrid was great. Anything and everything was done to try to stop the nationalist tanks. Streets were torn up, paving stones were turned into mountains of, mountains of paving stones were turned into barricades. The city is essentially turned into one giant battlefield in the anticipation that the nationalists will break through. As refugees flooded into the city, they brought with them stories of atrocities that the Franco forces were arbitrarily killing peasants and workers and militiamen that they had captured in large numbers. But there was also Republican killing and Republican terror within Madrid. The Republicans feared spies within the city, and there were indeed numerous nationalist spies within the city. The nationalist general Mola claimed that there were four columns of troops attacking Madrid and that there was a fifth column. This is where the term comes from, a fifth column of hidden supporters within the city. Whether there was or not, it's, or there were insufficient numbers for Mola's boast to be meaningful, is in doubt. However, it worked in terms of whipping the city up, and particularly the Republican government in the city, or the Republican military authorities anyway, into a sufficiently paranoid state that they began to arrest and execute those who were suspects. When German and Italian bombing raids on Madrid were successful and managed to hit Republican targets or civilian areas, it was widely assumed that it was nationalist spies that were guiding the bombs to their targets. This may have been the case in some instances, but undoubtedly it wasn't in others. As we know now about aerial bombardment in the 1930s and 40s, is a fairly hit-and-miss affair, and there is a high degree of inaccuracy to most of it. 2 days after the Republican government moved to Valencia, the international brigades arrived. These, as you know, we've talked about this before, were volunteers from across Europe and America and various other parts of the world, the majority of whom were actually French. There were exiles from Nazi Germany, there were volunteers from Great Britain and from America, Poland, and exiles from Italy too. The cheer that went up from the crowds, though, was invariably Viva Russia. And the belief was that these were Russian volunteers, and the crowd would be forgiven for thinking that, as these were men who were by and large organised by Comintern. But the main Soviet contribution to the defence of Madrid came from the actual supplying of military hardware, tanks and fighter aircraft, and fighter crews and tank crews to operate them were sent. The dogfighting over Madrid was visible. German-Italian planes were fought, and Spanish planes, obviously Spanish nationalist planes, were fought in the air by Soviet fighter aircraft. This was the first time that Soviet and German pilots would have dogfought with one another. The I-116 monoplane, the Mosca, as it was nicknamed by Spaniards, was technically superior to most of the aircraft that it faced in the skies over Spain. This technical superiority wouldn't last in the end. The Germans are quite able to innovate far beyond the Russians. But it gives you an impression, as foreign onlookers, the fellow traveller journalists and intellectuals who were in Spain, and ordinary Spaniards within Madrid would have been forgiven for thinking that the Soviets presented a real, powerful, credible threat to fascism and were able to take on the fascists in the skies. Unfortunately, obviously for Russia, by 1941, this turns out not to be the case, but that's, I guess, a kind of a different story. Without the international brigades, but mainly without the arrival of direct intervention from the Soviets, Madrid would have fallen very quickly. Franco announced that he would destroy Madrid rather than leave it to the Marxists, he said. And a news report at the time of the bombing of Madrid read rather like this. "There is nothing so harrowing and so criminal in all the world." This is from Louis Fisher, the American radical journalist. "I was riding in an automobile just before 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I noticed people running. Suddenly, there was a crash, and before one could think, a mountain of smoke rose above a five-story building down the street. We turned the corner. There was another deafening bang, and the bricks of the cornices mixed with wood and glass separated from a huge apartment house and fell across our path. A military motorcyclist asked for my car to transport the wounded. He was commandeering all automobiles for this purpose. Presently, they began to return with people who had lost limbs or parts of their faces. From the lower floors of bombed houses, women, old men and little children started to creep out. All was white, white hair, white faces, white clothes, powdered by crumbling plaster. A wrinkled old woman, wrapped in a blanket, every feature of her face trembling uncontrollably, stood on the pavement, dazed, and asked repeatedly, 'Where can I go?'" Ultimately, in November 1936, Franco fails to take Madrid, and it's only almost hand-to-hand fighting with the international brigades and obviously the intervention of Soviet air power that prevents this. Finally, Franco would take Madrid in 1939, but we will return to look at the fate of Madrid and the rest of Franco's campaign in Spain and the desperate battle that the Republic has for survival in forthcoming podcasts. Anyway, I hope you find this useful, and I'm going to be talking some more over the weekend on my normal eclectic range of topics and that kind of thing. Thanks for everyone that's supported me recently. We've had massive response to the podcast and lots of really, really cool stuff and really, really interesting messages from people. So keep it coming. I want everyone to be involved in these debates and discussions because, as I've said before, this is your podcast and not necessarily mine. Anyway, take it easy, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.